Coming up on Tech News Today, Kim.com's triumphant return to the web, Sony's getting thinner, and gigabit broadband for everyone in the U.S. Sort of. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, January 21st, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT1. And they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaffer.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feed. Good news and neutral news for RIM fans today. RIM announced the official change of the name of the BlackBerry App World Store to the BlackBerry World Store, reflecting the coming addition of content like movies and music. Also, RIM CEO Thorsten Heinz told the German newspaper Die Welt that RIM has not ruled out licensing BlackBerry 10 to other manufacturers or selling RIM's hardware division.
Mega Upload's successor, Mega, lets people upload and store files of any kind and went live on Sunday. Kim.com, formerly known as Kim Schmitz, the founder, has said that the new site complies with the law and warned that any attempts to take it down would be futile. Police raids on the offices and the home of .com led to the closure of Mega Upload last January.
Atari's U.S. operations has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The U.S. arm of Atari hopes that it can break free of its French parent. If it does become independent, the U.S. Atari would then try to find a buyer to take the company private.
With CES behind us, the announcement energy is beginning to focus on Mobile World Congress coming up in Barcelona. Korean news site iNews24 reports that Samsung's J.K. Shin confirmed the 8-inch Galaxy Note 8 phone will debut at Mobile World Congress.
Sony has introduced the Tablet Z, a 10.1-inch tablet, which is thinner and lighter than anything from, little companies like Apple or Google. It's powered by a quad-core 1.5 gigahertz processor, has an 8-megapixel camera, is 6.9 millimeters thick, iPad, I believe, is 9-something, will support LTE, and will cost, we don't know that part yet. Sony hasn't released where the Tablet Z will go on sale just yet either.
Ahmed Al-Kabaz, a Dawson College student who found a security flaw in his school's computer system, was expelled from that school. Al-Kabaz reported the flaw to his school and then tested to see if it had been fixed. He was then accused of launching an attack on the network, and Dawson College expelled Al-Kabaz because his test endangered the school's computer operations.
The new music-centric MySpace has over 50 million tracks, but the Merlin Network says not all those tracks are properly licensed. The agency says unlicensed tracks from more than 100 of its clients, like labels Beggars Group, Domino, and Merge, can be found on the site. MySpace says those tracks must have been uploaded by users and will be removed upon notification.
HTC's new flagship device, the HTC M7, rumored to launch at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona next month. Well, now we've got some photos obtained by Android Police. So, rumored specs for this phone include a 4.7-inch display, 1080p resolution, which is 468 ppi pixel density, a 1.7 gigahertz quad-core Qualcomm processor. In the images, it's also running Sense 5.0. That's the next gen of HTC's own OEM-specific custom Android skin.
In the second of our rumor trifecta in the news views today, PC Mag passes along that a new report from UK's Computer and Video Games, a.k.a. CVG, describes new controllers being tested for Sony's next game console, the next version of the PlayStation. The report suggests the new controller might sport an LCD screen like the Wii U gamepad and also work in biometric features right into the grips.
And one more rumor. A translated China Times report says that Apple will introduce a larger 4.8-inch iPhone with an 8-megapixel camera. The report calls the larger phone the iPhone Math, and it would be released alongside the iPhone 5S in June. Apple would then rev the iPhone again in the holiday season of 2013 with a 12-megapixel camera. So if you're keeping track, China Times says 3 new iPhones this year.
Do the math. That'll be their advertising slogan. Speaking of advertising, this episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace. The fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. I use it myself for several sites, including Sword and Laser, our science fiction and fantasy book club show that I do with Veronica Belmont. And what's great about Squarespace is the new version gives you the best mobile experience you can get. Squarespace has developed new templates with mobile-ready, responsive designs. Means your site automatically restructures to look great on any brand smartphone, tablet, or computer. When you add an image to your site, 7 different versions are created. So you got the right size loading for the right device. You don't have some massively large image trying to show up on a little 4-inch screen and vice versa. So your site looks professionally designed no matter what device someone is viewing on it. If you want your site to look good, to look professional, and you can focus on the content and the message of your website, and the person who's looking at it doesn't have to think, oh, I guess I need to look at this on my laptop or desktop, you want to try out Squarespace. The best part is, you can try it out absolutely free. They have a great importer tool. If you've got a current blog, you can just bring in your current blog, see what it looks like, play around with the templates, change the colors, pick different designs, and you don't have to do anything to try it out. It's absolutely free. You don't have to give them a credit card or nothing. If you do decide to keep the service and pay for it, do this. Use the offer code TNT1 and get 10% off your first purchases on new accounts. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code TNT1, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to discuss the stories in the news, Dana Wollman, Senior Reviews Editor at Engadget. Welcome back to the show, Dana. Great to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad. I'm sorry for you that you're in the office on what is a holiday for many in the U.S., but I'm glad for us that you were in the office so we could have you on the show.
Yeah, it's like we were talking about before, news is still flowing today, so some of us still have to be cranking out stories, right?
That's right. There's no Martin Luther King Jr. Day in New Zealand, so we still got lots of stories coming out of there about Kim.com's relaunch of Mega. Well, I guess it's not a relaunch. It's a new service, very similar to Mega Upload. It was launched on the one-year anniversary of the raid on .com's house in New Zealand. Everybody was there. A lot of the people who were in jail a year ago today, like programmer Bram Vanderkolk, CEO Tony Lentino is new to the company, actually. CTO Matthias Ortman was there last year. And in fact, over 500,000 signups, they said. 250,000 to 500,000, the numbers were bandied around. And Matthias Ortman said they've had to reboot the storage servers every hour. They're using Cogent in Germany for that stuff, and they've just been flooded. A lot of press on this, of course. What Mega is a file sharing service, a la Dropbox, to give you 50 gigabytes of encrypted storage. They're very much emphasizing legal use. They've got a new legal representative, Robert Amsterdam, on board of Amsterdam and Partners, along with their previous legal representation. The launch party was crazy Kim.com kind of stuff. Faux raid, pretend FBI agents repelling, security guards in miniskirts, weird stuff. They're at mega.co.nz, and they plan to roll out a bunch of new services, including Megabox, a music store, Mega Movies, a movie store, and something called Mega Key. Now, here's the interesting part. Mega Key is a replacement for your ad blocker. It's a piece of software you download from Mega. You install it on your browser. Right now, Mega's written in HTML5, only works on Chrome. They say they'll roll it out to other browsers. But when you run Mega Key, some of the time it replaces the ads you see with ads from Mega. So it's not an ad blocker. It's an ad replacer. They say they're only going to replace ads in search. Kim.com also said that it would only replace about 10% of the ads you see, would never replace ads from any site that was outside the top 100 Alexa-ranked sites. So they only want to annoy the really big companies out there, not the little guys. Dana, what do you think of this? Kim.com is a controversial figure as it is. It looks like he's trying to nail down Mega into being a more legitimate file-sharing service, but he's courting all kinds of controversy with this ad replacement side of it.
He is, isn't he? I'm rooting for him. I don't know if that answers your question or what you're getting at, but I'm rooting for him. I sort of love the impishness of this whole exercise of him coming back a year later on the specific day that he came back, offering such a generous package to users. And I'm in favor of not that I'm in favor of it, you know, that enthusiastically, but I certainly don't take issue in any way with the ad replacement. I don't have any ethical concerns about it the way I might with, or, you know, around piracy. It will be interesting to see to what extent the courts come after him and to what extent he's able to be as successful as he says he will. I mean, part of what makes this so fun is how certain he seems that his service is lawsuit proof in a way.
Yeah, he talks a lot about how they've you know, gone over all the legal aspects of everything. They've made it bulletproof. They're encrypting things. They're making it so you can only share files with yourself. You can still communicate with other users, but that's encrypted. Ars Technica has a story up kind of evaluating that encryption. There's some weirdness about how they're running the encryption, given that it's all written in HTML5. But he does seem to be trying to toe the line more with the file sharing part of it. And it's not illegal for someone to download a piece of software and run ad blocker. So he argues like, well, if you run our software and do ad replacement, you're gaining credits that will allow you to legally acquire music and movies, and we want to strike deals with people. Ayaz, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, it seems like .com doesn't know how to do anything small, at least. I mean, this giant party, and even giving out 50 gigabytes of space, that's a lot more cloud storage than you normally get from any other service, I think, at least for free. That's really, really impressive. It seems like he's learned his lessons from all that's happened with Mega Upload in general, trying to emphasize all the legal uses, trying to make everything look more secure, because to get people back, I think that might be a little bit difficult, because there's a lot of services out there that you could use instead of this, and if you're constantly worried about this service being shut down, you might not use it. So if they have to really put together a very impressive package to sign up a bunch of people.
I think that you just sort of hit the nail on the head, though, is that he draws so much attention to himself in every way on purpose. So this is the sort of thing where, yeah, okay, maybe they have figured out pretty much how to close every, you know, legal loophole here, and they have a legitimate service, but people are going to find any reason at all, certain people, of course, who are not fans of Mr.com, to take this site down. And Tom, you mentioned something like, well, this is, you know, it's a lot like what you could consider what Dropbox does as well. I always wonder, how much are other similar sites that offer cloud storage and a certain amount of gigabytes for free going to be affected by what ends up happening to Mega down the line when they do all actually become more and more similar?
Well, and one of the things that has differentiated a service like Dropbox from something like RapidShare is that they actively discourage you from using it to share copy protected stuff. They make a good effort, and they try to be good citizens. Somebody like the Kim.com in the past has sort of rubbed the industry's nose in it. He didn't think he was operating illegally before. He's avoided extradition. So far, he hasn't been brought up on any, you know, he hasn't been convicted of anything, I should say. So his problem before, I think, was caused by his attitude more so than just exactly what he did. And it seems like his attitude with this advertising thing is going to court more anger from people. But I don't know that that means that anybody can get at him, does it? Maybe it does. I don't know. We'll have to keep an eye on it. Let's talk about Thin. Thin is in again with Sony with the new Tablet Z. What's up with this, Ayaz?
All right. So Sony's at least they've announced this new tablet. It's the Tablet Z. It's like 2 weeks after they introduced their Xperia Z. So this is like their flagship awesome tablet. For specs, quad-core 1.5 gigahertz processor, 10.1-inch screen, 1920 by 1200 resolution, and an 8-megapixel camera, 6.9 millimeters thin. So it's thinner than the Nexus 10, thinner than the iPad. It weighs a little over a pound, which is less than the iPad and the Nexus. And get this, the Tablet Z is both waterproof and dustproof, but like Sarah mentioned, pricing and availability not mentioned at all. Dana, do you think thin and light can wow people in the tablet space? I mean, that seems to be a big push for laptops, but a thinner, lighter tablet.
Well, which people are we talking about? Do you mean mainstream consumers, or do you mean more people who read Engadget, who are just sort of obsessed with this sort of thing and, you know, read about this sort of thing just for the sake of tablets?
Let's go with consumers, because, I mean, they're at the end of the line. They're the people who are going to buy it.
I think thinness helps, but I think that can backfire in the sense that a thin chassis like this, I do question what size battery can fit inside. And I don't mean to dwell so much on feeds and speeds, but I think that is an important spec. And I do think it can backfire in the sense that you can have this really thin, really sexy device. But I think short battery life is the sort of thing that would cheese off even a consumer who didn't, let's say, know that much about technology. And I think also it depends what Sony has to bring on the software side. I mean, Sony can't do that much to single-handedly contribute to the selection of Android tablet apps. It's always been a little bit of a weak point for Android tablets. But Sony has been doing some interesting things on the software front, just in terms of sharing your media and accessing it on wireless devices in the home, you know, like televisions and wireless speakers and stuff like that. So I think there's so much that could make this interesting beyond just the thinness, which in and of itself, as I said, could be a drawback in some ways in the end. Who knows?
What about the dustproofness? That's kind of interesting. What does that even mean? Like, dust will be repelled away from the tablet? You can't get it dusty?
No, I think dust can't get into the machine, just like their Xperia line of phones. The idea is that it's tougher, so you don't need to put a case on it. Do you think that's going to make a difference? The fact that you don't need to... You have, a lot of these devices are super thin, super light, but you need to put a case on them.
Who has problem with dust getting into their tablet now? Is that a thing? Is that a problem that people have?
Well, I think the idea is that, what about the waterproof part?
The waterproof, okay, I'm kind of cool with that. Yeah, you know, you take it, I don't know, if you're at the beach or something, you worry about it all that much less. Okay, yeah, I think thinner and lighter is almost always better when you're talking about something like this that you'd be holding perhaps for a long period of time. But otherwise, I think the tablets are now adding things like, hey, you can get it wet and it won't get too dusty on top of specs that look a lot like other tablets.
I think Sony was trying to say, like, well, it's not just about thin, because their big advantage here is it's the thinnest tablet out there, right? 6.9 millimeters thick. You're right. Dana's totally nailed it. The battery life, I think I read something that they think it's like 6,500 milliamp hour battery. That's not great. It's Android 4.1. The rest of the specs are good. They're not like blow me away good, but they're fine. I'm not seeing the thing that really makes me excited about this particular tablet. Thin is not enough for me. Maybe it is enough for some. Dustproof and waterproof sounds like a gimmick.
See, I could see people going into a store, trying out the different tablets out there, and then figuring out, like, when they pick this up, they might go, this is actually different enough that it feels light. A lot of people do complain about reading on an iPad saying it's 1.5 pounds. It'll fall on my face and break my nose. This thing's a pound. It's less. I mean, it's pretty light. I'm pretty impressed with the concept of it being pretty tough. That's the thing for me, because I'm so sick and tired of getting these thin devices that get dinged or get busted because you need to put a case on them. Although I don't know if you can throw this thing around or anything, but to be waterproof, maybe as a parent, I'm like, waterproof is good
because people throw things. In the kitchen, that's something that, you know, I never want to put my iPad too close to the sink because you never know what's going to happen. Waterproof, I have to worry about it a lot less.
Dana, does a waterproof or dustproof make any difference? Does it sound like hype to you?
It could be. You know, this isn't technically the first tablet that I've heard of that's been billed as waterproof. Pantech had one. Pantech obviously is not nearly as big of a brand, especially in the U.S., but they were selling a waterproof tablet through AT&T, and I think that was sort of a dud. So remains to be seen if Sony can turn it, and Sony's marketing department can turn it into a bigger selling point than it has been in the past. I agree with Sarah that I think especially in the kitchen, even if it's not so much waterproof as splashproof, that could be useful. But is that going to make people buy this as opposed to another tablet? It all depends on so many other things. Battery life, app selection, of course, the price, which we don't know. What if this is really expensive?
Yeah, the price is going to make a huge difference on the attractiveness of this. I think you're right. Meanwhile, we all would like to have gigabit broadband like they have in Kansas City. And it looks like the FCC's got a plan to at least try to make that a reality.
Yeah, Julius Jenachowski spoke to a U.S. mayor's meeting. It was took place in Washington, D.C., and said, I want to see gigabit speed broadband services in all 50 states by 2015. So he's specifically calling on municipal leaders, service providers, to roll out gigabit speed broadband in at least one community in each of the 50 states in the U.S. in the next 2 to 3 years. So specifically, it's, hey, this is what I would like you to do as municipal leaders. He says, if you're participating in this, it's the Gigabit City Challenge, and communities could turn themselves into hubs of innovation. He says, it's proven to have worked in the past. He said, this is actually a quote, "If we build it, innovation will come. The U.S. needs a critical mass of gigabit communities nationwide so that innovators can develop next-gen applications and services that will drive economic growth and global competitiveness." He pointed to the fiber network that rolled out to 170,000 homes in Chattanooga. We've talked about that before on this show. Brought what the FCC says is about 3,700 new jobs over the past 3 years directly related to the fact that there was room for innovation because of infrastructure. What I think is interesting about this is it's almost sort of his just next gen initiative. He talked about the National Broadband Plan to Congress back in 2010. That was the goal of getting 100 megabits per second broadband to 100 million households by 2020. So this is sort of another challenge that is it's in a shorter period of time, but it's the same idea. I'll start with you. Do you think, sometimes I read all of this and I'm like, that sounds awesome. But what he's really saying is municipal leaders who may or may not have some serious budget issues, can you start rolling out this infrastructure that's going to be very costly at the beginning with the hope that it would pay off a few years down the line, as we've seen in a place like Chattanooga?
Well, I mean, if the FCC chairman is telling a municipal leader, look, your economy is probably doing really poor. One of the things you could do right now that's going to pay off for years is build this infrastructure out, or try to partner up with these other services like Google or any other company out there that does this. I mean, it's strange to think that internet speeds can make such a difference, but they do, because it'll attract people like the Kansas City experiment, where there's a bunch of startups living in a house together. They're all doing these things where you just couldn't do this with a slow speed. If you want to conference with people anywhere in the country, even, I mean, I guess technically, if you had all of these states that had all of this fast speeds, you could probably telecommute anywhere at that point, having a much more traditional style of office in a very untraditional style. So I'm hoping that his suggestions are heard and actually listened to. But, I mean, there's been a lot of pushback from private companies that just want to control all the pipes.
Dana, do you think it's overly optimistic to expect that this could be something that could roll out in all 50 states by 2015?
It might be. I mean, I think especially if you exclude companies like Google that have a little more expertise and also a little more enthusiasm and a lot more already vested in this. I don't know what happens if you leave it purely to municipal leaders who maybe know a little bit less about the technology and, like you said, have some possibly more pressing priorities and a tighter budget. But I'd be really curious to see how far the different states can get with cooperation, you know, with companies like Google and maybe others that have more vested in this.
Yeah, I kind of think that's the right way to go with this, is challenge the municipalities to figure out how to make it happen, not challenge the municipalities to build it themselves necessarily. In some cases like Chattanooga, that's going to work. In other municipalities, it's not. But you need to remove the restrictions. There's this kind of burgeoning movement out there in a few municipalities. We've talked about it in the Carolinas before, where competing ISPs get legislation put in place to prevent the municipalities from encouraging this or building it themselves. And I think that's absolutely the wrong way to go. I feel like we're finally getting to the point where we're all starting to realize the internet is a utility. It's like water pipes. It's like electricity. It's like the fire department. And so we need to figure out a model that efficiently delivers us that utility, allows competition and service providers perhaps on the pipes, but doesn't allow these de facto monopolies of cable companies and telephone companies, who then can just kind of sit back and go, you know what, we're not going to roll out fiber anymore, and we're not really going to spend money at the rate that would increase the capacity the way we want. So I like this.
Okay, Tom. Good. Sorry, I thought you were going to move on.
Oh, that's all right. Let's move on to RIM. TechCrunch reports that Thorsten Heinz was speaking to the German newspaper Die Welt, talking about all kinds of things relating to RIM. And some of the headline-grabbing quotes were about the possibilities after the launch of BlackBerry 10. He said that BlackBerry 10 is something they've been focused on. They've been trying to retool to make it a very good operating system. And then once it's launched, they can start thinking about what else to do with RIM. He said, before you license the software, you must show that the platform has a large potential. First, we have to fulfill our promises. If such proof happens, licensing is conceivable. So he's not ruling out once they launch BlackBerry 10 and they show how good it is, in his opinion, they could license that out to other carriers. Also, he said that they're still under strategic review at RIM, and so they might sell the hardware side eventually. They might not, but that's not off the table either. I said the delay of BlackBerry 10 was caused because they want to future-proof this. They want to come out with an operating system that will be good for 10 years, obviously with tweaks and building on it, but that it's adaptable. It's not just a smartphone operating system or even a tablet operating system, but it's available for embedded systems and all kinds of things that they can't even predict. All of these things seem to be the right things to be thinking about. The question is, Iaz, can RIM deliver this? Can they put out an operating system in this arena that's dominated by Android and iOS that gets people excited and wanting to license it?
I don't know if they'll get people excited other than using like a big marketing campaign, but I mean, the fact that RIM has taken so long to put out this operating system and these phones in general, it's showing that they don't want to come out with some stopgap Windows Phone 7 concept of like, oh, here's a thing that we're not going to support in a year. RIM has got a lot of work to make sure that the people that are loyal to them, because a lot of people still are loyal to BlackBerry phones and their services, that they've built the right operating system that's going to be around for a long time. As for them licensing it out, I mean, that could be an idea, but it just shows that at least RIM's got a goal. It's just simple. It's like, okay, our phones need to work right now, and this is going to be our operating system for a very long time. Other stuff we can talk about later.
Dana, if you had to make a guess, your best guess on the prospects for BlackBerry 10, what do you think is going to happen to it after launch? Will it be just popular? Will it keep RIM stable? Will it be really popular? What do you think?
You know, it's so hard to tell. I think many of us in the tech industry have been a little bit disappointed by RIM in the past few years. I think RIM is very good at building enthusiasm and excitement around its different launches. And I think people are already hotly anticipating BlackBerry 10. I heard a lot of people say that if they had snuck a BlackBerry 10 handset onto the floor at CES, they may have stolen the show and they probably would have gotten a lot of attention. And I think that the OS looks interesting from what I've seen of it. And I think a lot of people who I know in the industry agree. So I'm cautiously optimistic. I guess we'll see how well it's received. I guess to Iaz's point, they have been moving very slowly, and I don't know if that shows that they've been responsible and that they've been very fastidious, or that it means they haven't gotten their act together. So I'm cautiously optimistic, and I hope that if it gets to the point where they are licensing the software, it's not out of desperation, but because they actually have an amazing product that they can sell to other companies.
And like say, we certainly don't see Nokia wanting to license another operating system right away. Obviously, Android is probably the dominant operating system for somebody like Samsung. So I don't know, maybe an LG or an HTC would be willing to take a flyer on this if it gets some attention. Sarah, do you think you see people using BlackBerry OS 10 in the future in large numbers? Are you going to see it on the bus? Are you going to see it on the train?
Well, you know, somebody in chat said something like, to Iaz's point that some people really do still care about BlackBerry, said, I don't. I'm not loyal, but I have to use it for work. So I think that in the enterprise is going to be very, very interesting going forward, because the folks who still use BlackBerries in the enterprise, as long as BlackBerry 10 works great, you know, everybody's familiar with it, I don't see it there to be a huge mass exodus. But will any businesses adopt BlackBerry 10 as part of what their employees use at work that haven't already been loyal to BlackBerry? I think they really need something like that, or this is just going to continue to be BlackBerry holding on, money in the bank, but not innovating and growing in market share.
And they're going to have to compete the perception that BlackBerries are just for business. Samsung has an ad out right now that sort of hammers away at that. It takes pot shots at iOS in that ad, too. But it makes BlackBerry look like the old, out-of-touch person's device. And that's what their marketing is going to have to battle against. Let's talk about Path. Path is doing a little marketing spin of their own, trying to cast Facebook, what is a Chevy?
Well, okay. What is this? Yeah, there was a headline on TechCrunch that says, Dave Morin, CEO of Path, says, if Facebook is a Chevy, then we're a BMW. So everyone goes, ooh. Now, Dave Morin used to work at Facebook, so there's a lot going on here. What he meant, I believe, by this is Facebook is the network where you can have many, many, many friends. We're all connected. Lots of data. It does a lot of things for a lot of different people. Path is more of a specific performance machine. It's a smaller network. It's a closed network. You can have up to 150 friends or less. You're sharing more about the stuff that you care about with people that you care about more. It's more of that specific type of machine. So I don't think he was really saying, you know, we're luxury and Facebook is very pedestrian. He was speaking at the DLD conference that's happening in Munich, Germany right now. And he actually has quite a bit of interesting information about where the company expects to go in the next year. By the way, I am a very heavy Path user. I have exactly 150 friends. And every time someone adds me that I would like to have as my friend, you know, I got to like, who's got to be dropped? Who's not using this enough? The service has been extremely buggy lately. I mean, it is, I don't know what's going on with their servers right now, but I have to assume that there's a lot going on behind the scenes where some of the stuff I'm about to talk about will roll out sooner than later because Path is in some sort of a transition. Says that they want to move to more quantified self-type applications. So Nike Fuel Band is something that Path had officially integrated with so that you could post your Fuel Band score in your friends' timelines. He said, we spend a lot of time thinking about 100 people or less. So some of the most popular types of Path content are things like when people go to bed and when people wake up. You don't need too much of that. But with Path, there's some sort of a sweet spot that they believe really works because, again, there's just not that many people that you're sharing it with. He also says China is one of their top five markets, and he thinks that it has to do with the fact that particularly in China and other Asian cultures, there's a lot of emphasis on family, that a lot of families are using this. So it's not so much about 150 friends. It's maybe about, you know, your 12 closest family members, that private closed nature. He also says their new search engine on Path, which was introduced, in October, I believe. Because of that introduction, traffic had gone up 40%. And the service for search is right now only available in English. So as they roll out other languages, Spanish is next. And then Japanese, Indonesian, Korean, Chinese are all on the way. They see more and more use there. And then he also mentioned, this is like I wasn't really sure about this, that they currently provide premium filters and that they'll be rolling out new categories of virtual goods in the first half of this year. I don't know anything about any premium filters on Path. That's not something that I know to be offered at all. I can't filter anything.
I was just trying to figure out, how does Path make money? I can't remember. I don't see any ads on there. I was reading that the Nike deal doesn't give them any money.
Right.
So I'm really not sure what they're going to do to stay around. This idea of like, hey, we're really private and we're really great and we're luxury. But are you going to be around in the next 6 months? Premium filters sound like a good idea. At least there will be some kind of revenue generated there and Path will continue. But I mean, if you're just sitting around waiting to get bought by somebody else, that's not the best business model.
Well, you know, according to Morin, they're certainly not waiting around to get bought by a bigger company like Facebook. They're rolling out premium subscriber services this year. Morin says that this is stuff that might not even be interesting to a normal user, but intense users will want more options and may pay for that. That's another thing that kind of gets me. It's like, I know some of you are watching or listening and saying, you know, Path, either it doesn't appeal to me or 150 friends. I don't know. You know, I have like five people that I know that are on Path. So for someone like me, yeah, maybe if it was a cool premium service that helped me use it better, I might pay for it. But I just can't imagine that the majority of their users would care.
Dana, there's four premium filters on here that are 99 cents a piece. Old Time, The Grid, Loco, and 8-Bit.
Oh, premium photo filters. Okay, so I'm thinking like you can filter out people or put people in different folders. Where's this premium filter that I don't know anything about? Photo filters. Yes, that's true.
Would you pay for a mute feature?
Yes.
There you go.
Sure would.
They need different types of filters.
Well, Dana, are you a big Path user? Does this sound like they're on, you know, they've got a roadmap to financial success in 2013?
I admittedly, I don't use it, so I'm not invested in it the way you are. But the idea of paying for photo filters, that's a really dangerous thing. Not dangerous, but it's a little bit of a tricky concept. I don't think it's something people are used to paying for. And I don't know how well that worked for, say, Picnic before it was bought by Google. Remember the online photo editor? You could, in that case, too, you could sort of pay extra for certain funky filters. But I think the most obvious thing would be to just skip the ones you had to pay for. I could be wrong. I think people either will go to the services where they can get that for free or just use the things that they can quickly get without having to pay for them. Not in general, but at least as far as like something like a photo filter. That does seem like kind of a peculiar way to plan on making money for a service like this, don't you think?
Yeah. Tom, what do you think? I know that you and I have talked about how we enjoy Path and it's nice to have the closed network. Does it, they're certainly not on a path to a billion users or anything along the lines of Facebook. But then again, it doesn't sound like they're interested in that.
Yeah, I don't think they are interested. And I think that's smart. They're trying to carve out their own path. I agree with Dana. 99-cent, 8-bit filter, not getting me excited. Maybe I'm not the target market either. Maybe there are people who are really into these photo filters would be willing to pay that. But even then, it looks like you buy a filter once, you get to use it. You can even restore your previous purchases. So they're not selling them over and over and over again. There's only 4 of them. Obviously, Path is still early days. They make all their money from venture capitalists. So they're just trying things out to kind of see what catches fire. I'm very curious about virtual goods and that sort of thing. I pretty much use Path just to track my running with the Nike app. I almost don't use it anymore for anything else. Although my sister, who is kind of an early indicator of what might actually catch on with the average consumer out there, does use Path. And she's one of the few people who comments on my Path postings. Actually, Sarah's probably the other one. So I think, you know, you're on the path to a billion users. No. But do they have a future? Yeah, I think they're doing the right things to find out what works. Let's finish up with France proposing an internet tax.
Right. So France, they're talking about taxing the collection of personal data. Now, the idea came from a report entitled Taxation of the Digital Economy, commissioned by President Francois Hollande. The French think that some internet companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook are avoiding taxes in France. They do a lot of business there. France's argument is this. You collect very valuable data here. You don't pay taxes. Users in our country are effectively working for your services without pay by providing personal info that lets Google sell advertising. As an example, Google actually generates about 1.5 billion euros in advertising revenue in France, but it doesn't pay a whole lot of taxes in France. And this is how we work. The report says that tax rates would be based on the number of users an internet firm tracked, and that would be verified by outside auditors. Tom, do you think a tax like this that France is proposing, would that make companies think twice about reaching out and collecting data in France?
Well, it's going to cause a bunch of complications to figuring out, well, who is this user that wants to sign up for my service? Are they in France? If so, then, do I want to collect data from them or do I want to try to avoid the tax? It's complexity, and complexity added to the internet usually fails. Usually companies root around it or they just don't provide the service in that area. I get why, when you look at the budget of France right now, you want to come up with new ways to generate revenue. And I actually get the logic behind saying, hey, you know what? You're asking our people to give you data, and so that's something that we can legitimately say you're hiring them, so we're going to tax that. I get that logic, but I don't think it washes. I mean, it's an exchange. You give data, you get something out of the company usually, and that's not a monetary value. I don't think it's a very good idea.
Dana, do you think a move like this by France would be like overreaching to companies that aren't even in their borders?
I think it's overreaching, and I'm not quite sure if it seems to be presented as, I wonder if this is already covered by the terms of service. Do you know what I mean? The fact is nobody is forced to use Google services, to read Google News, to use Gmail, to use Google Search. And this is sort of to Tom's point. I feel like the transaction between the data and the internet company is sort of implicit, especially and maybe explicit in the terms of service. So I'm not really sure if there was really any room for ambiguity here. That's what confuses me here.
Yeah,
and I don't know if I see it as a monetary transaction per se.
Yeah, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, if Google's got good lawyers or tax lawyers, which they do, they're probably going to figure a way around this anyway. So this idea that France is trying to tax data collection, either they will figure it out technically or they'll figure it out following the rules.
Maybe you should pay a percentage of your data to France. It's not a monetary transaction. No.
Maybe.
Not buying it?
I'm not buying that, no.
All right. Well, let's buy North Korea then in the randomizer. Eric Schmidt's daughter was along for the trip on the delegation that went to North Korea. We talked about Eric Schmidt traveling to North Korea and pressing for more internet connectivity there. He was along with Governor Bill Richardson. Her account of the trip is getting a lot of attention, and it's really very interesting. She's put up a Picasa album of photos that she was allowed to take there and a nice long description on her Google site about the trip. So, you know, get a chance, go read it. Court, a nice summary of it and with links out to the different things. She talks about an internet center that they were brought in that she was said was very much like a Potemkin village. It seemed like it had just been set up for their amusement, for their benefit, and that people weren't even necessarily typing or clicking in a lot of cases. They were just sort of sitting there staring at the screens. Did any of you guys get a chance to take a look at this?
I love all things North. Well, you know what? That's going to sound weird.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
I am fascinated by people who take trips to North Korea, the pictures that they come back with, the stories that they have, and how much of it all seems to be smoke and mirrors. And whoever is the guest is sort of carefully led to particular places and told specific things. And yeah, this is it's fascinating to me. It really is.
Yeah, exactly. You want to say I love it because you love hearing about it. It doesn't mean that you actually love.
Certainly not. No,
it's fascinating to get a look in. It's almost like a controlled experiment because it's so tightly controlled, and so any look into it is just really fascinating. And this is a very interesting perspective on it. Not just the pictures, which obviously she's going to be restricted in what things she's allowed to see and take pictures of. Although she said they never stopped her from taking any pictures. So they obviously kept her in areas where it was okay. But her description of sort of the mistakes that were made along the way or the things that they weren't allowed to do, the form that they filled out, is really, really, really quite interesting. So I recommend taking a look. Let's move on to the calendar.
We've got a lot of earnings this week, and up tomorrow, IBM, Google, and Verizon are all announcing their earnings January 22nd.
All right, it's earnings time.
Yep,
earnings
it sure is.
Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got an email from Josh in Greenville, South Carolina. AT&T crew, I work for a non-tech Fortune 500 company that also proudly boasts being a Fortune's 100 top companies to work for. I think I can shed some light on this list and why some great companies don't appear on it. The number one reason why is something people most people don't know. Companies actually have to apply to be on it. They submit a campaign on why they deserve it, and a small random sample of employees get sent a questionnaire. So if Apple doesn't appear on the list, it's more than likely due to the fact they didn't even apply to be on it.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was the case, that you have to almost campaign to get on the list, because the list does seem to be generally pretty comprehensive. So I guess most companies participate in that.
I can definitely see, if this is all true, Apple's just sort of being like, no, we don't. We don't even want to be in a competition. We don't want to be on a list with 99 other companies. Even if we're number one, we do our own thing.
They probably don't want the employees getting a questionnaire and filling it out. It's like, you stay quiet.
Right. Yeah. You don't get to say that this is the best company to work for. Just work. That's a secret.
I never worked at a company that required me to do this. There were other campaigns at CNET Networks before CBS bought them where they're like, hey, fill out this survey. But it wasn't the Fortune one. Dana, have you ever run into this?
No, never.
Yeah.
I work for AOL, and I think AOL, my guess is that AOL would like to be featured on something like this. I've never actually had to fill out a survey or anything like that. But no, very different corporate environment. No one telling us to keep quiet about how well we're treated or anything like that.
how you're treated at all. That's good to know. Well, that is it for this episode of the show. Dana, thanks so much for joining us. It's always good to have you along.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, senior reviews editor at Engadget. But let folks know where they can find you online, follow what you do.
Thanks for having me. I'm at Engadget.com, and if you want to follow me on Twitter, my full name, Dana Wallman.
WOLLMAN for those on the audio podcast. Definitely worth a follow. And you can find us on our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com is the place where you can submit stories. Let us know what kinds of things you'd like us to talk about, as well as vote on the submissions of others. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is TNT@twit.tv. And give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow with Brian Dunning as our guest. See you then.